Hello and welcome to the Best of Science World. Today on the Best of Science World, we'll feature some of the most interesting conversations we've had on our program's one-on-one segments. So stay with us for this special edition of VOA Science, Health, and Technology Magazine, Science World. Ever since the Mars rover Curiosity touched down on the surface of Mars during the summer of 2012, the mission has been a huge success for NASA's Mars Exploration Program. In a study that was published by the journal Science, a team of scientists found some geological signs of an ancient stream bed indicating that water once flowed on the Red Planet. That finding supports prospects that the planet could have once been able to support life. That study was co-authored by Don Sumner, a geologist and a professor at the University of California, Davis, and a co-investigator for the Mars Science Laboratory team. Professor Sumner talks about her team's discovery and the role geology is playing in the Curiosity's goal of determining the habitability of Mars. Professor, I must admit that reading the headline, Ancient Stream Bed Found on the Surface of Mars, really caught my eye. What did you and your colleagues find?
We found rounded pebbles, and it's something you find in stream beds all over Earth, and they're very common, but we've never seen these on Mars.
And where on Mars did you find it?
We found them in Gale Crater at the landing site of the Curiosity rover.
And I understand that you played a key role in selecting the Curiosity's landing site. Why was Gale Crater selected?
We actually selected it because there's this mountain in the middle of the crater called Mount Sharp that has layers of rocks. And those layers record the history of time and the environments in Gale Crater. And so we landed in a flat area near the mountain because you can't land on a steep slope. And we planned to drive to the base of the mountain to look at those layers.
Professor, I understand that this discovery was made with using the very basic principle of geology. Can you please tell us about them?
Yes. So the pebbles are rounded, and when you break up a rock, the edges tend to be sharp. To get them rounded, they have to collide with each other and collide with sand, and they do that when they're transported down the stream bed, and it takes a lot of collisions to make rocks round. And so it's a very basic principle that's the first lab I teach in my class to geology majors, that to get rounded pebbles, they have to be transported a lot.
What does this finding show you and your colleagues?
This is some of the first proof on the ground that there was flowing water on Mars that lasted a long time in transported sediment a long distance. So a flash flood, just one or two flash floods, can't round pebbles like this. It requires more continuous water flow with the pebbles banging against each other. So that means there was water flowing on Mars for an extended period of time.
So speaking of which, finding this stream bed with the geological clues your team uncovered, have you been able to determine or at least hazard a guess as to when water might have flowed across it?
Well, we don't know the actual age when these rocks were deposited. We know that it's more than 2 billion years ago, maybe 3 billion years ago. Getting the age is very difficult, something we all want to know, but it was early in Mars history.
The Mars Science Laboratory mission with the Curiosity rover is quite unique in that it's using the science of geology to help answer some important questions on the Red Planet. Mostly, was it able to ever host life? Can you share some of your thoughts on this mission from a geologist's perspective?
It's thrilling to be able to do geology on another planet. And we've had a taste of this with other missions. We can look at the planets and use telescopes and remote sensing to get a lot of information. And that's how we knew Gale Crater was a good place to go. But the rocks on Earth and on Mars record clues to what happened billions of years ago. And as geologists, we're trained to interpret those. And with the engineering team, we've built and landed and are operating an amazing field geologist that also has some great lab chemistry experiments.
Professor Sumner, I understand that you helped coordinate the first scientific interpretations of what was seen during Curiosity's first few days on Mars. You helped direct the rover by computer and shoot photographs of the planet. Now, as a geologist involved in such a key role with the MSL mission, how do you determine where the rover should go, what it should explore, and where samples should be taken?
Well, that's something that we do every day, and it's a lot of careful observation. We take the pictures to be able to see where we are, and when we first landed, we saw pictures of these rounded pebbles, and we talked as a team. There are several hundred people on the team. We talk as a team about what they mean, and then a few people who are really interested in the problem work together to figure out what observations do we need to do next. And so it's a big collaborative effort with lots of discussion, and eventually we have to come to consensus about where to go and what to do.
I'm quite curious, Professor Sumner. I know that the mission itself has a number of goals it hopes to reach. Do you have any personal goals you hope to accomplish with your involvement with the mission?
My biggest personal goal I've actually reached already and will continue to, which is to learn something that's brand new. As a scientist, I really enjoy struggling with difficult problems, making observations and analyses, and starting to understand those problems. So this story on the rounded pebbles, it was really exciting to pull together, but we still don't know exactly where they came from or where they were, where the water flowed from. And so we still have lots of those sorts of questions to ask. And we're looking for other environments that could have hosted water and trying to understand if there was ever life on Mars. We may not be able to answer that, but it's a really interesting question.
That was Dawn Sumner, a co-investigator for NASA's Mars Science Laboratory mission, as well as a geologist and professor at the University of California in Davis, California.
You're listening to The Best of Science World on The Voice of America.
Ecosystems are defined as the relationship and interactions between different organisms and their environment. Scientists are especially interested in what happens when humans are introduced into those ecosystems. At the University of Calgary, Marco Musiani and his colleague Tyler Muhi have completed a 5-year study on the activity of wolves, elk, cattle, and humans across Canada. And what they found is that the effect we humans have on ecosystems and the food chain has been greatly underestimated. Findings from their study, they say, could play an important role in putting together new long-term and more effective conservation strategies. We spoke with Dr. Musiani, who tells us about what he and his colleague learned from their research and the impact it could have on future conservation efforts. I noticed that two accepted principles of how ecosystems naturally operate could be overshadowed by the importance of human activity. What are those principles and what did you find?
There are some ecologists that like to believe that all that matters is good soil, water, sunlight, productivity of plants, which therefore means a higher abundance of herbivores, which therefore means a higher abundance of carnivores. There are some other ecologists that found out that this system is also driven from the top, meaning that in areas where there are many predators, then there is less prey, and then there is less overgrazing. So the first is a system that is driven from the bottom, from the plants, bottom up. And the second mechanism is driven from the top, from the predators, top down. What we found is that depending on the abundance and activities of people, we have in nature either top-down mechanism or bottom-up mechanism, and humans are always the most dominant and influential species in the system.
Dr. Musiani, in general, are we humans doing more harm than was thought previously on the animals in the wild and the various ecosystems?
I would say that we should accept that humans are the ultimate ecosystem engineers, and if you speak about harm, well, I don't have an opinion on that, but let me say that even in national parks and protected areas where we think there is wilderness, even there, there are millions of visitors, for example, in Yellowstone, and even there, humans might be the most abundant species at time, and they might be the most influential species. So yes, human impacts have been underestimated.
Dr. Musiani, can you give us why you think that the research and the findings that you and your colleague made are important for ecologists to understand?
There is theoretical contribution that we are providing. We are basically indicating that the most important keystone species, so the species that has the most influence on the ecosystems is humans. From a practical or applied point of view, our contribution is that it is a bit misleading to sometimes focus our effort on diminishing densities of predators or sometimes focusing our effort into promoting plant productivity when really we humans are already influencing the system in ways that should be first studied, and then we look at what we humans can do to change our practices to make the ecosystem function.
What kind of impact do you think that your study will have on various conservation efforts around the world?
I want to give you an example. Now, in the U.S., there is a big debate about the return of wolves. Wolves were reintroduced in the Yellowstone and northwestern United States areas, and they expanded. And there are a number of conservationists that say that it's good for the environment because wolves are diminishing the densities of prey, so there is less overgrazing into the environment, so therefore wolves contribute to biodiversity. I think that we should also focus on what humans are already doing in all such environments, outside protected areas and also in Yellowstone. And we will find that these systems were already influenced largely by humans, and we should understand how these systems were evolving with humans, with or without higher densities of wolves.
What kind of behaviors can we humans change or modify that would have less of a negative impact on the ecosystems and the animals that survive in it?
I would say that the input of this research is to have kind of a realistic assessment of what humans are already doing before engaging in major campaigns, for example, of predator control or of prescribed burning. And predator control, again, is designed sometimes to drive the system from the top, and prescribed burning produces good habitat for grasses, so it's designed to drive the system from the bottom. Either way, we should first have an understanding of what humans are already doing in all environments, again, in and outside protected areas.
That was Dr. Marco Musiani from the University of Calgary in Alberta, Canada. Thanks for listening to the Best of Science World. Today we're featuring a few of the best one-on-one conversations we've had recently with researchers, scientists, innovators, and other newsmakers. If you have a topic that you would like us to cover on our program, or would like to hear an interview with one of your favorite science-based personalities, let us know. You can do so either by sending us an email to science@voanews.com or by visiting our webpage and blog. The web address is voanews.com/science. Over the years, we've heard a number of reports warning that unless we stop or seriously slow down our output of greenhouse gas emissions, we face some very serious climate and environmental consequences, with some of the findings predicting near-apocalyptical ramifications. While long-term global warming is expected to be consistent with established and conventional estimates, a study from Oxford University shows that there has been a warming pause over the past decade, and that at least for the next 50 to 100 years, those extreme projections are looking less likely to occur. Dr. Alexander Otto from Oxford's Environmental Change Institute led the investigative team, and he joins us to talk about its research and findings. What did your team's research find?
We used the latest data available, especially including temperature data on the last decade, which has been reported to have a decreased rate of warming. So there is this warming pause that we see in the temperature record. And then, of course, the question is, does this now mean that climate change isn't happening or isn't happening as strongly as we thought before? And so we were following up on that question, and we find two very interesting insights. The first insight is that if we look at the very long-term response of the climate system to our emissions, which we call climate change sensitivity, a very specific term, then we find that the estimates that we come up with are actually relatively consistent with former estimates. So I would summarize that as, in the very long term, we are still looking at severe climate change if we don't change our emission behavior. But the second and more interesting result is that another characteristic of the climate system, which is the shorter term response, it's called the transient climate response, there we find that we actually have a slight adjustment downwards, not just in the expected value, the best guess, yes, but also in the range of uncertainty, we have a slight adjustment downward. So what that means is we are essentially looking at the same long-term warming, but maybe a bit slower than we thought. A calculation example for that, if we managed to just double the concentration, then we would look at the consequences that we would have expected to happen by 2050, mid of the century, to happen just 10 or 15 years later. I wouldn't say that would justify saying that climate change isn't happening, but it shows that we still have quite some uncertainty about how strong it might actually react to our emissions, and it tells us something that we are not as certain about the timescale at which it might happen is still changing.
Dr. Otto, I'm quite curious about this thing that you call global warming pause. What is it?
What we are doing is we just look literally out of the window. We look at surface temperatures. That's the temperature taken at 2 meters above ground. And then, of course, we combine all these temperature measurements and we add satellite data and other data. And we still talk about global mean temperature, which means just taking the average of all the measurements. And then we look how this changes over time. And we've seen quite an interesting and dramatic increase over the last 40 years, I should say, with the 80s and 90s having the highest rates of increase of temperature. But from the very warm year 1998 onwards, there has been a lower rate of increase. It hasn't actually stopped. We still are seeing a very slight increase in temperature since 1998 and through the 2000s, but it has certainly been less rapid than in the decade before. And this has then been phrased by many people, warming pause, and this then has, of course, been used in discussions around whether or not climate change is happening or not as an argument against climate change happening. Whereas on the scientific side, we would actually expect single decades to jump around a bit, because we don't just have the long-term climate signal, the climate change signal, as response to greenhouse gas emissions and rising concentration levels, but we've got noise in the system. We have what we call decadal climate variability. So it can well be that one specific decade is a bit colder than the long-term trend would indicate, but then the next decade might work as the 90s were, really, really strong increase. So this is kind of the context for how we measure global warming and how it has paused over the last 10 years.
Speaking about the warming pause, especially since greenhouse gases and industrial output has continued to rise steadily over the years, why all of a sudden a pause in the global warming?
Our particular study has looked at, given that there was a pause, what does it mean for the future projections? But there has been other recent work that actually looked at what's the reason for that. So we are saying that the greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, the rising concentration of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere captures more sunlight or more energy. And then the question, of course, is where has this energy gone? And one explanation that, among others, but the major explanation is that it was the upper oceans that have actually taken up more energy than before, and therefore it hasn't gone into increase the temperature so much, but it was the upper part of the ocean that has taken up this heat over the 2000s.
That was Dr. Alexander Otto from the Environmental Change Institute at Oxford University in the United Kingdom.
This is the best of Science World on VOA.
While a number of scientists are looking to find life beyond Earth, one group of researchers has devised an explanation for how life began on this planet. And it turns out their work points to extraterrestrial possibilities. The scientists found that a heavy bombardment of meteorites during Earth's earliest history delivered reactive phosphorus. When released in water with other minerals and incorporated into prebiotic molecules, life could form. The researchers found this form of phosphorus in ancient limestone that was abundant some 3.5 billion years ago. Matthew Pasek, an assistant professor of geology at the University of South Florida, led the team of researchers. He joins us to talk about the work that suggests life on Earth may have been able to get its start with a little help from deep space. Professor, you and your team found that a key element of life on Earth came to this planet eons ago. What was that element and how did it get here?
The element is phosphorus, and phosphorus is an important element in biology. It's sort of the number five most important after carbon, hydrogen, oxygen, and nitrogen. And so phosphorus is important in making up your DNA and in controlling how you use energy, both in terms of getting energy and using energy. And it makes up our skeleton, so it's an important element in a variety of different functions.
Wasn't there any supply of phosphorus already here on Earth when the planet was formed and began its evolution?
Yes, there was. The Earth actually has a fair bit of phosphorus on the surface as well. A good portion of that may have come from meteorites, but a lot of it was already here. And so the thing with the phosphorus that's already present on the Earth is that when you have this phosphorus around, it's in the same mineral form as what our bones are made of. It's a mineral called apatite. And apatite is a pretty inert and non-reactive rock or mineral in many cases. And so in this way, it's one of those things that you don't tend to find it too reactive, which is great for our bones and our teeth, because if it was reactive, then it would dissolve away whenever you ate some food, and that would be pretty awful for our teeth.
If you could, bring us through a scenario with the phosphorus coming to Earth on a meteorite. How did life develop from that?
That's a great question. That goes on beyond the just the phosphorus idea. But if you have a meteorite, it dropped onto the surface of the Earth well after the Earth has kind of had a chance to kind of cool down and form oceans and things like that. And so the environment actually becomes better. And when you have an iron meteorite, iron and water tend not to go together very well and get rusting and things like that. And for at least phosphorus, the phosphorus will react with the water, generating these forms of phosphorus that are kind of unusual for the surface of the Earth. Most of the Earth's phosphorus is in a phosphate form, but when we have a meteorite, we actually get different forms. And it's actually the different forms that we see in the old rocks that give us this idea that meteorites were important. But if you have this meteorite sitting on the surface and sitting in some water, and some organics are also in that water, things like sugars or alcohols and things like that, they can sit and react with the meteorite and the phosphorus minerals and become phosphorus-rich biomolecules. And it does so pretty well, and we're getting some better idea of how well it is doing that and kind of figure out how these sorts of biomolecules even came about.
It's amazing how much the Earth changed since it came to be, the cycles that it went through. One thing I found interesting in the material about your study is you said that the conditions under which life arose on Earth billions of years ago are no longer present today. Now, what are we talking about? What were those conditions?
Well, one of the biggest condition change is how life has actually changed the atmosphere. So all the oxygen that you're breathing even today is made by photosynthesis by plants that turn sunlight and carbon dioxide into oxygen and sugars. And that oxygen comes around and wreaks havoc on a lot of different very simple minerals. And it starts to oxidize them and rust them out and prevent some others from forming. And so that's definitely one of the biggest indicators that something was different is we see the rise of oxygen about 2.5 billion years ago. And before that, there was not much in the way of oxygen. It's hard to find rocks that kind of go back that far, but at least as far as we can tell, the atmosphere of the Earth did not have oxygen and had a number of different other things going on with it, one of which is this different variety of phosphorus that was probably present on the early Earth chemistry.
In doing the research and going through your findings, did you come across an aha moment or something that really surprised you?
Well, this was one of those moments in science that it kind of worked out well, because we've had this idea that meteorites could have delivered phosphorus for a little while. We first started doing research back in the middle of the last decade. But in recent times, we've finally been able to develop the techniques available to analyze these rocks. And so it came about that once we started actually getting these techniques and could actually analyze them, this was the first thing I took a look at, were some of these old rocks I had sitting around to try to figure out what was going on with the phosphorus. And it was one of those, I think it should be there, and hey, it is there, yay! And that was the one of those very exciting moments of science when your prediction actually matches what you find, as opposed to going, whoa, what the heck is that, which is a lot of science as well.
That was Matthew Pasek, an assistant professor of geology at the University of South Florida in Tampa, Florida. That's our show for this week. We hope you enjoyed looking back at a few of our more memorable one-on-one segments on the Best of Science World. Before we go, we'd like to invite you to visit our website and blog. The address is voanews.com/science. You'll find stories, program information, links, and much more. So stop by and visit us on the internet. The Best of Science World has been produced at the VOA Studios in Washington, D.C. by Bob Doty, and I'm Rick Pantaleo. Be sure to join us either online or on your radio next Saturday and Sunday as we check out the latest in science, health, and technology on Science World.